J'ai tout remis en question, ce que j'ai pu apprendre à l'école.
Se dire, comment je fais avec les pucerons?
As you become the seeds of change in any place in the food web.
En m'intéressant non pas à ma plante dans mon champ, mais en m'intéressant à mon champ dans un environnement que je contribue à fabriquer en quelque sorte.
Proven local practices combined with scientific knowledge provide the best guidance.
Ça n'a rien à voir avec ce qu'on a pu apprendre dans les lycées agricoles classiques.
Donc l'agroécologie, ben, c'est, on allait dire, ça fait partie des savoirs traditionnels de n'importe quel paysan ou paysanne du monde entier.
Le meilleur concepteur d'outils, c'est le paysan.
C'est un très fort niveau de technicité, l'agriculture économe, autonome et la vraie agroécologie.
Et puis de pouvoir comme ça durer pendant des années sans abîmer mon sol, sans abîmer le petit morceau de planète qui m'a été confié.
It's not going to be, not only going to be individual actions that's going to make a change.
Que veut dire l'intelligence? L'intelligence, c'est pas forcément sortir le premier de Polytechnique, je veux dire.
We need to all get behind associations, movements that are going to change the system.
It's not only techniques, but it's also a tool to change our society.
Hello everyone. This is a podcast series about knowledge transfer in agroecology, hosted by six organizations from different European countries, all working under the Erasmus Plus project, Bridging Generations in Agroecology. Our partners are from France, the Netherlands, Germany, Switzerland, Italy, and Poland, and we all have different perspectives on agroecology, which is why the concept is so hard to define. Fundamentally, agroecology is considered a set of agricultural practices based on ecological principles that reduce the impact of agriculture and, when done well, can even regenerate our environment while providing just access to food for many. In the context of this project, Bridging Generations in Agroecology, we hope to promote a more global outlook on agroecology. We may indeed come from different countries and live agroecology in our own ways, but all the partners agreed on a common definition of agroecology found in the Nayeni Declaration. The Nayeni Declaration was written in 2015 during the International Forum on Agroecology in Mali, which gathered smallholder farmers, fisherfolk, herders, pastoralists, and indigenous peoples. In essence, these are all the small players who are usually seen as the beneficiaries of development projects tackling malnutrition, poverty, and food insecurity, but rarely have they a say when it comes to writing those projects. So the Nayeni Declaration was and is a tool to have their voices heard and to make a platform under which a diverse group of peoples can become allies and express their vision for the transformation of the food system. The main teaching of the Nayeni Declaration is the understanding of agroecology as a global concept that isn't restricted to the farm scale. 11 pillars have emerged from the exchanges between those participating in the International Forum, highlighting the strength of people's agency, the material and immaterial link connecting us to other human beings, to animals, to territories, and to the earth. The declaration emphasizes women and youngsters' key role, as women have always been those making and teaching agroecology, and the younger generations are both responsible for the safeguarding of knowledge and the guarantors of its future. Those 11 pillars are unambiguously naming the structures of power that are freezing food systems and that must be abolished to carry out an agroecological transition, especially regarding seeds, water, land rights, and biodiversity. If you want to know more, you can read our guidebook that describes different definitions of agroecology and explains the 11 Nayeni pillars in more detail. And perhaps in the future, we can present a deep dive into the Nayeni Declaration as part of this podcast. But for now, let me explain how these episodes will be structured. For the next six episodes, we will be focused on civil society and indigenous peoples organizations in global governance spaces. This one in particular will serve as a little introduction before we explore the more global and local context of governance in episode 2, the challenges we face as civil society and indigenous peoples in episode 3, before we take a little deeper dive into peasants' rights in episode 4, indigenous knowledge and wisdom in episode 5, and the role of research in episode 6. I'll try my best to make every episode around 30 minutes long. So, let's get into it. Today we will hear from Nora McKeon and Kanayan, whose two short interviews will explain how civil society and Indigenous peoples organizations move around in global food governance spaces. Nora McKeon is going to explain how food producers organized in social movements can progressively enter global spaces of governance and why they chose FAO, the Food and Agricultural Organization of the UN, as the strategic institution where to invest their time and energy to make their voice heard at the global level. Her interview shows how the growing participation has led to impressive results thanks to civil society's capacity to organize. Before we jump into Nora's talk, I would like to address some of the acronyms she uses so we can better understand what she's saying. The MST is the Movimento dos Trabalhadores Rurais Sem Terra, the Landless Peasant Movement in Brazil. The WTO is the World Trade Organization. FAO, as I explained earlier, is the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations. The IPC is the International Planning Committee for Food Sovereignty. And PPP is Public-Private Partnership. Now that those acronyms are all clear, let's jump in and hear from Nora herself.
Hello, my name is Nora McKeon. I'm based in Rome with the NGO Terra Nuova. I also teach at Rome 3 University. And during much of the period that I'm going to be talking to you about, I was actually working inside FAO. I was responsible for FAO's relations with civil society, peasants' organizations. So I was one of the actors in this story that I'm going to be telling you about. Now, why is it that peasant organizations and social movements started to reach out to FAO to become interested in FAO? This has its roots in the mobilization of rural people's organizations, especially from the mid-80s on, as they reacted to the terrible impacts of globalization and neoliberal policies on their livelihoods and their territories. It began at the local level up to the national. MST was born in 1984, the Senegalese Peasant Platform in 1993, all the way up to the global. La Via Campesina saw the light in 1993, just 2 years before the creation of the World Trade Organization. So as this was happening, actors from these different movements started to come together to reflect on a strategy to build their capacity to make their voice heard at the global level in order to influence these policies that were having such an impact on them back home. And from this reflection came the idea that FAO, in the world of the UN, in the international world, would be possibly the most promising alternative forum to the WTO. Why? There were several reasons for that. On the one hand, it's more democratic governance as compared to the WTO. The FAO is part of the UN. And of course, with all the criticisms and all the insufficiencies of the UN system, it is nonetheless the most democratic international governance that we have, because it's one country, one vote, even though some countries' votes have more weight than others. And all countries are members. It also has a specific focus, of course, on food and agriculture, and its mission is to eliminate hunger in the world. It also has what is known as a normative role, that is, its role is to constitute a space in which governments can come together and agree on policies that affect food and agriculture and hunger. And finally, FAO was relatively open, as compared with other parts of the UN, to engaging with civil society, and in particular with small-scale producers organizations. So this was the choice that was made by the movements, And the opportunity to put this reflection, this assessment into practice came when the Director General of FAO, Jacques Diouf from Senegal, decided to organize a World Food Summit in 1996, and again a second one in 2002. This was the period in which a whole series of global UN summits and world conferences were being organized on the environment and development, human rights, women, etc., etc. But this, the World Food Summits were exceptional in the sense that the civil society forums that were organized in parallel to them, there were always civil society forums, but in this case, the organizers made a deliberate political choice to put social movements, small-scale producers' organizations, consumers, in the front row in terms of deciding what messages would be taken to the official proceedings. And not only that, but also they raised enough resources to be able to cover the travel costs and lodging of people from these movements so that they would actually be in the majority among the delegates. This was totally exceptional because in all of the other cases, it was, for obvious reasons, northern NGOs who tended to dominate the scene. They had the resources, they had the facility of being on the spot, et cetera, et cetera. So it took a real political determination to turn this around. And the result was very strongly felt, both in the content of what came out of these forums and also the way in which these forums were able to act as an occasion for networking, for building up relations among different pieces of the movement, because, you know, it wasn't so obvious. Indigenous peoples didn't always get along with peasants, and fisher folk, who knew about them, and pastoralists were totally out of the scene. So having the occasion of bringing all of these pieces together, getting the consumers talking to the producers, this was really, really important. And it was also very much appreciated by the Director General of FAO, who was a politically astute person. He understood that it was important for FAO to be on good terms, to have an alliance with the movements, the organizations of the people who actually produced the food and carried out the agriculture and the fish and everything that the organization was concerned about. And so he decided to sign a formal letter of agreement, an agreement with the IPC. The IPC grew out of the effort of organizing these two conferences. So it began to organize around the 1996 conference, and it was formalized at the time of the 2002 conference. It was the 2002 conference that adopted food sovereignty as its agenda and gave a formal mandate to the IPC to carry this agenda forward and to be its interface mechanism with FAO in dealing with the different aspects of the agenda, which of course you're all familiar with: the right to food, access to and control of resources, etc. So the agreement that was signed between the Director General of FAO and the IPC was extremely important because, first of all, it recognized the principles that were going to govern the relationship between this intergovernmental organization, FAO, and this civil society mechanism. Again, this was the first time in the UN world that an agreement of this kind had been developed. And the basic principle was that FAO recognized the autonomy of civil society and its right to self-organize in order to dialogue with and negotiate with FAO as an intergovernmental organization. And it also recognized a number of priority areas in which both the IPC, the organizations of the IPC, and FAO agreed to work together. One of these was the right to food, and in fact, one of the first important activities in which the IPC was engaged was the negotiation of the voluntary guidelines and applying the right to food at national level that were negotiated in the Committee on World Food Security and adopted in 2004. And that was followed very quickly by the organization of the International Conference on Agrarian Reform and Rural Development in Brazil in 2006, where the IPC played an extremely important role in this conference, which led to attention really being given to agrarian reform again as an important as an important item. So the IPC was able to organize participation by rural people's organizations and FAO technical committees and regional conferences. And so for this reason, when the food price crisis came along in 2007, the IPC was in a strong position to take advantage of it and to really mobilize to influence the reaction of the international community. The international community, if left to its own devices, would have been perfectly happy to simply go along with business as usual. But thanks to the pressure of the mobilization of the IPC and civil society, aligned with the strong support of some important Latin American countries in particular, Brazil and Argentina, but also some European countries, and of course the FAO, the decision was made instead to reform the existing but ineffectual Committee on World Food Security in order to transform it into an authoritative, inclusive policy forum for seeking answers and solutions to the structural, the political causes of food insecurity. This reform was carried out in 2009. The IPC and its organizations played a very strong role in it and won a lot of important aspects that characterize the Committee on World Food Security and that make it really exceptional as an international policy forum. It is recognized as the foremost inclusive and international intergovernmental platform on food issues, not one among many, but the most important. The defending the right to food is included explicitly in its mission. Civil society organizations, with priority to those who represent sectors who are most affected by food insecurity, are recognized as full participants for the first time in UN history. They intervene on the same footing as governments, and their right to autonomously self-organize is recognized. They are not confused with the private sector, which happens in all of the quote-unquote non-state actor mechanisms that exist elsewhere in the UN. An effort is made to ensure accountability through monitoring, and the governments are urged to establish similar multi-actor inclusive platforms at national level in order to bridge the gap between global policies and national situations. And there have been some important victories since the reform CFS started to work in 2010. Just to mention a couple, the tenure guidelines that were adopted in 2014, the first ever guidelines in this delicate area that are now being used by social movements around the world to help communities defend their rights. Another important area in which the CFS has proved to be extremely effective is that of changing the narrative because of the possibility of bringing in of peasant organizations, fisher folk, indigenous peoples, rural women, all of these actors coming into the room and speaking for themselves. This has made it possible to challenge the dominant discourse on a whole series of important questions. In the policy recommendations that have been adopted in the CFS since 2011 on, it has become recognized. This is not opinion. This is recognized assessments that are underwritten by all the member governments of the CFS that small-scale producers are responsible for the bulk of the food consumed in the world and for 90% of investment in agriculture. So they're real economic actors. They're not just cute little farmers out there in a village. And what's more, it has been recognized that most of the food consumed in the world never gets anywhere near a supermarket. It transits through what could be called territorial markets, markets that are embedded in the social, cultural, and economic texture of particular territories. So these are the most important in terms of food security, and it's also where the vast majority of small-scale producers actually engage. So this is an attack against the dominant discourse of global value chains and the importance of agribusiness leading the way and transforming small-scale producers into entrepreneurs, etc. These important gains have already influenced the framing of the Global Action Plan of the UN Decade for Family Farming, this wonderful opportunity that we have now to make a lot of changes, and it's important that it be brought that they be brought to bear on the national action plans that are now being developed. But I have to say that the political context has changed enormously since 2008-2009. We find ourselves in this situation of populist, anti-democratic governments, including Brazil, who is one of the champions of the reform of the CFS. The EU is more divided, less strong on human rights. The USA, no comment. And we have at the same time a significantly increased concentration, corporate concentration in the food supply system, and presence in the Committee on World Food Security. So the whole narrative of private sector investment being necessary and PPPs, all of this is quite strong, as well as, we know, the growth of multi-stakeholderism, this approach to governments that allows everyone into the room on the same footing without making distinctions between roles and responsibilities, issues of power imbalance. And of course, that means that the strongest actors, the corporations, are the ones who lead the scene. And an enormous effort is being made throughout, pushed by the World Economic Forum, which brings together all of the corporations, to substitute this kind of governance for the kind of governance in which governments, in the end, are the ones who take the decisions and are responsible for applying them, in which governments following a human rights framework are responsible for ensuring the rights of the people who live within their territories. So we see this in the current proposal to hold a food systems summit, possibly in New York, in any event, under the aegis of the United Nations and the World Economic Forum. The two of them have just recently signed a partnership agreement. And this is a recognition of the importance of food issues, and we can only be happy about that. But it is definitely an effort to divest the Committee on World Food Security of its political significance and to challenge the kind of inclusive democratic governance that the CFS is such a great example of. So more than ever, we need to mobilize and defend what we have gained in all the work that we've done to bring the CFS into being and to use it to good effect since it's existed.
Nora McKeon there with some strong words reminding us of the reason for the Committee on World Food Security's existence, which ring pertinent. Considering the failure of CFS 50 to reach any accord due to the current state of global politics. We're going to finish this podcast with a quick talk from Kanayan of the Farmers Association of Tamil Nadu, who will reaffirm that trade agreements negotiated with the World Trade Organization are destroying local markets and increasing hunger in the world. The Committee on Food Security and FAO, as places devoted to the realization of the right to food, are the right place where to negotiate global policies on food and agriculture, explaining why so many social movements are active in these two UN fora. So, let's hear from Kanayan.
My name is Kanayan. I come from India. I belong to Tamilaga Vivasayagal Sangam. It's a farmers association in India, which is a member organization of La Via Campesina. In the world, the number of hungry, food insecure, nutritionally insecure people's population is on the increase despite the efforts taken by the Committee on Food Security of the United Nations, which is based in Rome. I find it very difficult for the committee to make sure that the hungry population is adequately fed by making the policy documents here in Rome, because the food and nutrition issue is adequately dealt by the trade agreements. This WTO is responsible for making the corporations to advance the trade interest in food security issues. Food produced in one continent is fed to the people in another continent. There is inequality in the world, like there are countries who are resource poor, farmers who are resource poor, and there are countries who are having plenty of resources to produce, and also the treasury of the governments are pumping in a lot of subsidies in the developed countries in agriculture. Those agriculture producers are, through the WTO rules, used to destroy the peasants' market in the developing countries. So peasants are getting out of their farms, or in my case in India, since 1995, the year WTO came into existence. Afterwards, until now, more than 350,000 farmers who have committed suicide due to the market failures and the failing income at the end of their produce reaches the market. So I would demand that all the policies related to food and agriculture should not be with WTO. Agriculture should be completely taken out of WTO and free trade agreements. And the Rome-based agencies, mainly the United Nations Committee on Food Security and the Food and Agriculture Organization, should be the supreme bodies to govern the food and the food systems in the world. The National Food Security Act, more than 50% of the country's population is benefited by the public distribution system. Government of India is buying the produces from the small and marginal farmers and stocking those produces and distributing to the poor people. The same farmers who are poor also accessing food through this food security program. United States, European Union has taken this matter in WTO and challenged India's food security program. We fought this, the government fought, civil society fought, and we were given a peace clause, which means that until a certain period they will not take India to the dispute settlement body, which means the peace clause is not a very strong clause, which is associated with a lot of conditions. We cannot anymore expand our program. From the beginning of the Uruguay round of negotiations, La Via Campesina, peasants' movements across the world, has been demanding that agriculture should be out of free trade agreement, GATT agreement. This is the fight we have been continuing for decades. But the same people who are making the policy documents in CFS are there in WTO. They want to bring the WTO rules to stop the Committee on Food Security to make any policies overriding the WTO rules. That is dangerous. That's why we are not able to make food and nutrition as a rights of the people and leading the world towards progressive realization of the right to food and nutrition.
And that was Kanayan with his short but powerful talk, bringing in his perspective as a farmer from India. So that brings us to the end of our first episode on civil society's role in the global governance of food systems. I would like to say thank you on behalf of all of our partners to our two speakers today, Nora and Kanayan. And we hope to invite you all to our second episode soon. Stay tuned, and thank you very much for listening.